Welcome to Akatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. We're diving deep today into, well, a true giant of world literature, Naguib Mahfouz's The Cairo Trilogy.
Absolutely. We're talking about the whole epic sweep, Palace Walk, Palace of Desire, and Sugar Street.
It's such a foundational work, and Mahfouz himself, I mean, the first Arab writer to win the Nobel Prize for Literature.
Exactly, 1988. He's often called the father of the modern Arabic novel, and you really see why here. He's like a cultural archaeologist digging into Egypt's transformation.
He really is. So our mission today, for you listening, is to explore how this massive family saga tracks the Abd al-Jad family. We're following them across three generations.
From 1917 all the way to 1944.
Right. And mapping their, you know, their very personal, intimate struggles against this huge backdrop, Egypt's incredibly turbulent shift from tradition towards modernity.
It's the personal and the political deeply intertwined. You could say it's the story of a whole nation finding its feet, mirrored in the breakdown of one family's home.
Okay, let's start by setting the scene properly. We begin in 1917. World War I is raging elsewhere, but we're deep in old Cairo.
In the Gamalia district, these old winding streets, Mahfouz makes Cairo more than just a place. It feels like a character itself, a microcosm of everything human.
Definitely. But the absolute center, the engine driving this whole story, is the patriarch, Ahmad Abd al-Jawad.
Oh, Ahmad. He's such a powerful, almost chilling figure. He embodies this deep paradox.
Explain that paradox at home.
At home, he's the prosperous spice merchant, yes, but he's utterly fearsome, a tyrant demanding total, unquestioning obedience. His family lives in, well, constant fear of breaking his rules.
But then he steps outside.
And he's a completely different person. The moment he's out of the house, he leads the secret life.
A hedonistic life, right?
Absolutely. He's charming, witty, out drinking, singing, enjoying the company of entertainers and courtesans. Nights filled with pleasure, completely hidden from his family.
And this hypocrisy, it isn't just a personal failing, it's structural. It's what holds the whole repressive family system together.
It really is. And what's brilliant, I think, is how Mahfouz connects that personal hypocrisy to the national situation.
How so?
Well, the struggle for freedom inside the house, under Ahmad's dominance, it directly mirrors Egypt's national struggle for independence from British colonial rule.
So the core tension is this balancing act.
Exactly. For the family and for Egypt as a whole, how do you hold on to cherished traditions while also embracing changes that are, well, necessary and unavoidable?
That tension is palpable right from the start in part one, Palace Walk.
Yes. This first book really establishes that patriarchal cage. The atmosphere in the house is just suffocating.
And at the heart of it is Amina, the matriarch.
Amina. She's the picture of the traditional, pious, submissive wife. Her entire world is the home. Her life is just service to her husband and children.
And the daughters, Khadija and Aisha.
They're almost ghosts in their own home, confined mostly to looking out through the mashrabiya.
That latticed window, right?
Exactly. It's such a powerful symbol. They can see the life on the street, the freedom out there, but they can't really join in. It's mediated, constrained experience.
We talk a lot about Ahmad's tyranny, but Amina,
yeah,
she's fascinating too. She makes this one act of defiance.
She does. Venturing out without permission just to visit the Al-Hussein shrine while Ahmad's away, it seems small, but for her it's huge, requires real courage.
And the consequence.
Swift and brutal. Ahmad finds out, throws her out of the house just like that. He reasserts his absolute power immediately.
But she endures. She comes back.
She does, and her quiet strength, her resilience. Maybe that's the point. In that world, maybe quiet endurance was the only path forward for women like her. Her submission becomes almost a strategy for survival, not just weakness.
Meanwhile, outside those walls, the political world is heating up.
Yes. Enter Fahmy, the idealistic son, studying law.
He gets swept up in the nationalist fervor.
Completely. The 1919 revolution against the British occupation, his personal awakening is tied directly to this national movement.
Which leads to the tragedy at the end, book one.
Heartbreaking. Fahmy ignores his father's orders to stay safe, joins a demonstration, and is killed. Shot dead, he becomes a martyr for the cause.
And his death. It's the first major blow to the family's isolation, isn't it?
It shatters it. It forces Ahmad, the patriarch, to face something beyond his control, the limits of his own power. Grief hits them all.
A devastating end to the first part, and it propels us into the 1920s and Palace of Desire.
Yeah, the second book sees a shift. The family starts to disperse, physically move out, and you really feel Ahmad's power starting to wane as he ages.
And the eldest son, Yasin, what becomes of him?
Ah, Yasin. He seems to inherit all of his father's appetites for pleasure.
But none of the discipline.
Exactly. None of the control or the ability to maintain that respectable facade. He just stumbles through life, multiple failed marriages, affairs. It's chaos. He represents tradition dissolving without anything solid to replace it.
But the real focus shifts, doesn't it, to the younger son, Kamal?
Absolutely. Kamal becomes the trilogy's intellectual and emotional core. Many see him as Mahfuz's stand-in, his alter ego.
We follow him from childhood curiosity into young adulthood.
Right. He goes to teacher's college, becomes an intellectual, and in this book, he suffers this profound double
At
loss.
first is romantic.
Deeply. His intense, unrequited love for Ayida Shaddad.
Describe her.
She represents everything his family is in. She's from an aristocratic, westernized background, modern, alluring, but ultimately inaccessible to him.
And she rejects him.
Completely, utterly. And it's more than just heartbreak. It's a harsh lesson in class difference, in the gap between traditional Egypt and this new Western-influenced world he aspires to.
It feels like a metaphor for Egypt's own complex relationship with the West at the time.
I think it is. He reaches for that modern world through Ada, and it pushes him away, finds him lacking.
And the second loss, it's even deeper, perhaps.
It's a crisis of faith. His studies, his exposure to science, to Darwin, to philosophical skepticism, it dismantles his traditional religious beliefs.
His mind undercuts his heart, essentially.
Typically, he's left wrestling with that huge existential question for his generation, and maybe ours too. Is there any way to reconcile a heart that still loves God with a mind that has killed him?
That question still resonates so strongly. It highlights how slow and painful cultural shifts can be.
It does. It leaves Kamal as this archetypal, modern figure, educated, thoughtful, deeply skeptical, but also kind of paralyzed by it all, detached.
Which brings us to the final volume, Sugar Street. We jump forward again.
Right into the 1940s, a very different Egypt, politically turbulent during World War II.
And Amon.
The patriarch.
He's a shadow of his former self, frail, diminished. His era is clearly over, even before he dies.
And Kamal.
Still observing, cynical, detached. He's chosen contemplation over action and seems somewhat resigned.
So the focus shifts again, this time to the third generation.
Yes. The ideological battles of the nation really come home to roost with Khadija's sons. They embody the starkly opposing forces fighting for Egypt's future.
What are those forces? On one hand, you have Abd al-Munim. He becomes a passionate member of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Which was a rising force then.
Very much so, gaining ground, offering an Islamic alternative to what they saw as failed secular Western models, advocating for a return to fundamentalist principles.
And his brother Ahmad.
The complete opposite. He's drawn to socialism, becomes an atheist, passionately committed to a secular progressive vision.
So the national conflict is literally playing out within the family.
Around the dinner table, it's intense. The divisions that are tearing Egypt apart are right there, embodied in these two grandsons.
But life's personal tragedies don't stop just because the world is changing politically. Aisha suffers terrible losses.
Oh, it's heartbreaking. She loses her husband, her children. It's a brutal reminder that modernity, ideology, none of it protects you from basic human suffering and loss.
And the trilogy closes with Ahmad's death.
Yes, his funeral marks the definitive end of that patriarchal age. But Mahfuz doesn't give us a neat resolution, not at all.
What happens?
The final image is unforgettable. The two grandsons, Abd al-Munim the Islamist and Ahmad the Socialist, are both arrested for their political activities.
By the state.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they're thrown into the same prison cell, side by side.
Wow. So the future is left unresolved.
Completely unresolved, precarious. The family, like Egypt itself, is fractured, forced into this tense coexistence by an external authority. It's a powerful, unsettling ending.
Okay, let's pull back and talk about some of the major themes Mahfuz explores across this huge canvas. The decline of authority seems central.
Absolutely. You see Ahmad's entire arc from this fearsome tyrant everyone has to obey to this lonely, nostalgic old man at the end. His power doesn't just fade with age, it becomes kind of irrelevant in the face of modernity and his children's independence.
The patriarchy crumbles from within and without.
Right. He dies, but the system he represented was already weakened long before.
And what about the women? Their resilience feels like a quiet counterpoint.
It really does. Amina's endurance, Khadija's practicality, even Aisha's tragic path. They show this slow, undeniable shift in women's roles and visibility. Their options are still limited, drastically so, but their inner lives become more central to the story as it progresses.
Which connects to that theme you mentioned earlier. The personal is political.
Mafose masterfully weaves them together. Fami's death isn't just a family tragedy, it's part of the national struggle. The grandson's arrests aren't just about them, they reflect Egypt's political crackdown.
History isn't abstract, it happens in people's living rooms, in their hearts.
Exactly. There was that line in the notes we reviewed, something like, love is the bridge between two hearts, but society builds the walls.
That determine whether that bridge can be crossed. Yeah, that captures Kamal's situation with Aida perfectly, doesn't it?
It really does. The personal desire was there, but the social cultural walls were just too high.
And briefly, on Mafu's technique, the realism is striking.
It's powerful. He uses this omniscient third-person view, which lets him give us both intimate access to the character's thoughts and feelings, and this broad panorama of Egyptian society changing over decades.
And the symbolism? The house, the streets.
So potent. The house is safety in prison. The streets, palace walk, palace of desire, Sugar Street, they represent the pull of the outside world. Freedom, temptation, politics, danger, everything the house tries to keep out.
Thinking about why this work endures, Mafu's really tapped into something universal, didn't he? That anxiety of living through rapid change.
He did. That quote you mentioned, the past is a beautiful dream and the future is a terrifying hope, that captures the feeling so well.
So thinking about it together, why does this story still hit home today?
I think it's because it shows that search for meaning, for freedom, is constant, even when everything around you is in flux. Tradition, revolution, skepticism, people are always grappling.
Yeah, and it reminds us that huge historical shifts are always felt, ultimately, in the small personal dramas of individuals just trying to live their lives.
It grounds history and human experience, showing the costs and sacrifices involved in moving between worlds.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.